Donald in a Kitchen talks about food. Donald in a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Priskintas.
We get together here once a week at the KHOI Community Radio Studios in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donna Lana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Yes, we do. Thank them for their support. And thank you, you the listener, for joining us today. On the Donalana Kitchen, we talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. We're going to be talking about recipes today and how we talk in the kitchen about what we do, how we teach each other. And, oh, in the meantime, I want to report that 2 days ago, despite the awful weather today, I saw my first robin.
Okay, folks, this is the middle of February. I guess those guys got the message about climate change. What are you going to do?
It was a robin. I looked twice. It's still winter, however.
I bet he didn't look very happy
today. He was kind of sad.
And those usually, like last year, those fat robins come through first. That's the males.
Ah,
remember we saw them?
That's right.
All of these really fat robins, and it looked a little like, what is this? We had to get some ornithology. Is that the word, ornithology? Mm-hmm. The bird experts. We had to call them bird people.
So, it spring will come, but it is still winter. So, today we are going to think about recipes and how we learn to cook. There's cookbooks, there's recipe cards, and those scraps of paper and those Facebook posts and things that we send each other. We kind of share recipes a lot of different ways. And besides that, there's TV and video and all those devices.
And we learn to cook by eating.
We do. We do. We learn to trust our own tastes. So today we're going to be talking about recipes and rhetoric. Today, we have a special guest. We're going to explore the language of the kitchen today. And joining us is Abby Dubasar. She is a professor of rhetoric at Iowa State University. Welcome to our kitchen.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Good. She is also a professor of rhetoric, assistant professor in the English department. But she's one of those magic people that have many affiliations, which is nice. That's how we learn things, many affiliations. She's also an affiliate faculty for the Sustainable Ag Department and the affiliate faculty in the Women and Gender Studies Program.
Yes, that would be Rhetoric, Agriculture, and Women's Studies. We can relate to that.
So, Abby, I've been meaning to ask, what is rhetoric?
That's a really good question. So, thinking about rhetoric as a term, people in my field are very invested in how rhetoric can reveal the art of persuasion and how individuals and communities use persuasive strategies. So even going back to the days of Aristotle in the mid-300 BCs, he described rhetoric as locating the available means of persuasion so that in any communication situation, we have available to us as rhetors, as persuaders, these available means that can help us. And so, you know, definitions of rhetoric do proliferate. There are many out there. And most of my training is in feminist historiography and rhetoric and thinking about how rhetoric works differently for different populations. So for people who want to know more about nuanced definitions of rhetoric or the ways folks in feminist rhetoric have defined it, currently, I really like this definition by Jackie Royster and Gisa Kirsch in their book, Feminist Rhetorical Practices, of thinking about rhetoric as an embodied social experience in ways that facilitate persuasion, that facilitate communication more generally. So even thinking about your radio show as a form of persuasion, this embodied social experience, right, that might get your listeners to think more about food, think more about recipes, try something new. I really like this term embodied social experience, because any rhetorical situation or communication opportunity has embodied elements, has lots of factors going on with it beyond the words we speak or the words we read, that sort of thing. I can say more, of course, if you want me to go on.
This reminds me of an old saying, be careful what you say, you may have to eat your words.
That sort of fits in, yes. We're very much concentrating on talking and listening when we're on the radio, but when we're talking about food, there's also taste involved, and I think that's a way to communicate with people, too. Abby, you got involved in interest in food and recipes and women's roles in cookbooks. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So when I first started thinking about what sort of research I wanted to do in rhetoric, I initially embarked on a big project that turned into my dissertation about women's peace activism and how women have developed arguments against war, arguments for peace, and the way they have to account for gender and the way they have to, as embodied people, use persuasive strategies that work as someone who may be marginalized or othered in a certain communication context. So that project went in a lot of different directions, and some of the materials I couldn't really account for in my dissertation were cookbooks that peace organizations published. And in the rich and long tradition of community organizations publishing cookbooks, I have this very small archive, and anyone is welcome to come to my office on campus and look at these anytime they'd like to. But they're really, some of them have fundraising purposes. Others have a lot of different rhetorical purposes, including trying to save people time in cooking so they can dedicate more time to their activism. And so I have this range of cookbooks in the 60s, from the 60s through the early 80s that I've written about. And then in 2010, the peace group Code Pink published a cookbook called Peace Never Tasted So Sweet, Women's Delicious Recipes for a Sweeter World. And then more recently, there have been another surge in these sorts of cookbooks like Feed the Resistance by Julia Tertian. And so what some of these newer versions do is combine genres, which is really interesting to me as an English professor. So if we have certain genre conventions for a cookbook, in the most basic level that you open it up and there are directions for cookery, right? And we have expectations for books about activism, then what we see these authors doing is combining those into one context. And since I'm very interested in political orientations toward rhetoric and thinking about gender as political, I'm really interested in how women especially have subverted a genre like a cookbook to combine these different purposes.
Does this make food itself political? I mean, you wouldn't, oh, everybody has to eat, but since women, well, traditionally have been the food providers, does this give kind of another kind of power to food?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And I think people are excited to talk about how food is political. The emerging interdisciplinary academic field of critical food studies is very invested in, for example, how oppressions are built into our food and food systems. So,
oh, really?
Yes, in thinking about
And one way is to denigrate food preparation, women's work, all kinds of women's work, that it's tedious, that it's boring, that it's not really important, that it's some kind of subtext to the rest of what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I, of course, object to all of that strenuously.
Thank you, Donna.
Yeah, and even fitting Donna's point into the, you know, long tradition of women perhaps being assumed to take on care work that isn't valued in different contexts, too. Like if we think about food being related to care, but obviously we all have to eat every day, so we're all implicated in these interlocking political systems. So in my research, in a project I'm doing currently, some of my participants have talked about food being political. If we think about the $15 minimum wage and how it would affect fast food workers.
Absolutely.
Or if we think about the different ways.
And that is part of the denigration of food preparation, is it's underpaid or not paid at all.
Exactly. Or if we think about the people who pick some of our produce and all these different ways that the food choices that we make are built into systems and come with systems that may be invisible to us or maybe we know about them and we still, you know, undervalue them,
you see,
too.
It's true. All food labor is at the bottom of of wage earning, except for very highly paid, mostly male restaurant chefs.
Mm-hmm.
And their books, which I always call food porn, because most of the product coming from this kind of elevated culinary status is quite complicated to prepare. And you look at a book like that and you immediately feel inadequate. Oh, I could never do this. Well, first of all, you would probably never want to do this. It's pretty. And that's why I call it food porn. It's an exaggerated statement of nutrition, just the way, you know, sexual porn is. It's not real.
There's a huge variety. There's these wonderful, accessible cookbooks and recipe cards that people pass to one another. And on the other end, there's these big coffee table books. And, yes, those gorgeous pictures. And you always must remember those big books with the beautiful pictures, they have staff.
Ooh, lots of staff. Lots of underpaid staff, as a matter of fact.
There you go. There you go. So what sort of things did you find in these? Oh, yeah, so many interesting recipe books sitting here. What sort of things did you find?
So I can speak about the Code Pink book specifically. Maybe listeners of yours have heard of Code Pink and thinking about, again, like subverting the color pink as a traditionally, quote unquote, feminine color, but making it political as a critique of George W. Bush's terror color alert system. So on the back cover of the book is the phrase, if I can't bake, I don't want to be part of your revolution. So, for example, I teach a gender and communication class at Iowa State. And one thing we discuss in the class is what it means to have a feminist identity, the sort of history of feminism in the United States, and thinking about members of the third wave movement, this idea that a person can embody what may be seen as traditional feminine values, such as loving to bake, but also having a political orientation. And I think that quotation sort of sums it up. So I've used that quite a bit in my publication about these books, in thinking about being able to embody multiple versions of having an orientation toward food and cooking. So that's an example. That's one of the findings of my research on these books, is that multiple generations can relate to one another through cooking and through baking, even if the issues that are important to them as feminists aren't the same. You know, if they're fighting for access to STEM fields versus access to higher ed at all, that sort of thing. Those issues are really important to my students, so they become a linchpin for discussions. Another interesting finding in these cookbooks to me, as someone who loves thinking about food and cooking, is that sometimes, again, in these sort of cookbooks or different subgenres of cookbooks, like Donna's talking about, there's recipes in here that represent many different sorts of approaches to food. So on this on page 78 of the Code Pink book, there's a raw vegan berry pudding pie. And so people who use a raw diet and think about foods that way have a recipe in this book. And then there are really more traditional, what we could think of as maybe traditional recipes in here, or even very different ones. There's a Cajun truck driver shrimp pie from a Code Pink member in Texas. And so what I argue and think about in my research in these cookbooks is, would these two recipes exist in the same cookbook in any other context? And sort of questioning how we can have
kind of inclusivity. That's
exactly,
you know, and I think we should just, I'm going to read what it says in case we don't know all what Code Pink is. Code Pink is a women initiated grassroots peace and social justice movement working to end the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and stop wars and redirect our resources into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life affirming activities. So this is very women centered, and of course it's, even though it's a fairly new organization and you may think it's all young people, this is what women have always done.
Yes, absolutely.
Life-affirming activities.
That's right.
Nurturing, cooking. And it's, you know, it's been considered support rather than the main work. But, you know, increasingly, obviously, it is the main work of humanity.
Right. And it's still, you think, well, they've been around for a while. And yes, still. Wars in Iraq, wars in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We're still working on it. I want to get back to this wonderful statement, if I can't bake, I don't want to be part of your revolution. I believe there was, it's the kind of thing you'd find on a T-shirt, right? And it's the idea of a phrase, words that are strong enough and meaningful enough that everyone gets it. Just that little. I haven't had a T-shirt back in my day that said, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution." Mm-hmm. I think that was credited to Emma Goldman. But anyway, same thing.
We're still doing it.
And that's a really good example of rhetoric as embodied social experience, right?
Mm-hmm. Embodied.
Yes, exactly. So getting to Donna's point, too, of the long history of women's involvement with peace activism and thinking about what's been done in this work, I wanted to read some. This is literally from the recipes. So now I'm going to read from the book Peace de Resistance, a cookbook by Esther Lewin and Jay Rivkin. This was published by members of Women's Strike for Peace, and it was published in 1970. So in Code Pink's cookbook, for example, that was published in 2010, they have separate recipes for activist strategies from the cooking recipes. But in this book, the authors have combined them more. So in a recipe, I'm on page 25, called Beef, Bird, and Garden Casserole. After the directions for the recipe, they've written, if you've got a street corner leaflet distribution scheduled for the next day, make this casserole a day in advance. And they have other gestures like that that are about ways to combine cooking with your activist work. On page 35, there's a recipe called Mary's Mishmash. And it says, the directions after the list of ingredients say, did you rush off to demonstrate with such enthusiasm that you forgot to take something out of the freezer for dinner? Here's the solution to that problem. We wish it were this easy to solve problems like war and peace. Mix all ingredients in heat. Serve in deep bowls with French bread and salad with oil and vinegar dressing. So they've much more deliberately combined the political angle of their cookbook, too. And this happens throughout the cookbook as well.
Well, I was noticing, and let's talk about Feed the Resistance, which is a very...
Yes, yes. That's
a brand new book,
yes.
Basically. One of the things they're doing in there, and I have done a lot of this, is... There are how to scale up recipes because you're feeding groups,
yes.
Community dinners that or community over the years, especially in my environmental work, I have encouraged multiple environmental groups to make the food at their events follow their political principles,
yes.
As in using local, as in using organic and presenting foods that have been sustainably grown, and that it's sort of the old we have to walk our talk, although I have to say Wes Jackson used to make a joke. He wanted to have a T-shirt which said, if we have to walk our talk, we'll never get there. Of course, he's always a bit of a comedian. That's Wes Jackson at the Land Institute, who has he's a geneticist who's developed a perennial ever-producing wheat, among other things. So, but this idea of food at the center of political and community gatherings is an old thing.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, one of the things we have to look in our community, how many religious and civic organizations have community kitchens? Every church has one. Every Elks Lodge has one. Every VFA hall has one. We have been eating communally, and food has been part of our political and communal conversations for a long time.
Yes, absolutely.
So the idea in this cookbook, Feed the Resistance, recipes and ideas for getting involved, one of it is how to feed large scale, how to scale up recipes.
Absolutely. Yep.
Good. Yeah, good things to know. Go ahead.
I can't find it while I'm sitting here, unfortunately, but in one of the books, there's thinking about that same idea of being able to feed people under the constraints you're working, like needing to feed many at once. There's a recipe, I think, and it's in this book. It's called Piecemeal, a Cookbook from the Greenwich Village Peace Center. Mm-hmm. And this is the only book I have so far that doesn't have any sort of gendered element or isn't part of a women's organization. It's from this Peace Center in Greenwich Village. But they have variations for a soup depending on how much you can afford to spend on a really, really big meal. Mm-hmm, so thinking mm-hmm. about how to make something really delicious if you have $30 to spend on it versus $5, that sort of thing too,
very
which I think
important.
And is
to,
ingenious.
To
yeah.
factor in the space that you're cooking in, the limitations
yes.
of the kitchens, the limitations of the people who are preparing the food or the gifts of the people. Quite a lot of skill can go into this. And, of course, you always have to worry about food safety and food temperatures and the logistics of it can be quite fascinating.
Yeah, all this mm-hmm. information that is shared it's important to the survival of the species here. I think how we eat and how we get along in our society. Yes, it is. I'm going to take a little break here and say this is KHOI. This is Community Radio, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a tune called Kitchen Girl, of all things, from a fine CD, from a real nice man who's up in Wisconsin playing music and doing dances and stuff. His name is Tim Jenkins, plays a fine fiddle. That tune was called Kitchen Girls. His CD is called We're Cooking Now. Yes, and we are here, too. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are around our kitchen table today with Abby Dubasar, and she's talking about rhetoric, how we speak, how we convince each other to do things, how we make a better society. She's a professor at ISU in the English department, and she's brought in lots of good examples of how we communicate in the kitchen, not just how to make the food, but how to affect our culture.
Right. I think this is a really good conversation for us because we often talk about the politics of food and the politics in the food system, but we haven't talked that much about the politics of cooking, mm-hmm. which is very political because it's gendered. Do you remember the way to a man's heart is through his stomach?
I thought
food
that'd be, yeah.
as seduction.
It works, but it's kind of messy, you know. That we need to
well, anyway. You know, I mean, but really it's about nurturing.
That's true.
It doesn't have to be seduction. We all have to eat.
Yes, Abby, you've got something to say. Well, many things. You studied the history of talking about this subject. Can you talk about what you found about women and women in the kitchen?
Yes, absolutely. So thinking about Donna's point, too, I wonder if you would – what you would think about talking about baking specifically. Like, is there something about baking as a subset of cooking? So another example that I've used in my research is this cookbook called The Great Day Cookbook by another peace organization. It was published in 1982 or 83, but they had this quotation in it, and they named it The Great Day Cookbook because they have the quotation that you've probably heard before, won't it be a great day when schools are fully funded and the military has to hold a bake sale
yes,
to buy a bomber?
That's from the 70s,
exactly.
I think.
Exactly, yeah. And
old,
so
old bumper sticker.
Yeah, yep. Thinking about sort of bake sales as a way that non-funded organizations get funding and different things like that, too. That's something that the authors of these cookbooks are really interested in pointing out and thinking about more. And then when women are leading the charge to hold those or to organize those and create food for them as well, too. So
Well, baking is, you know, it's about desserts, which are kind of considered non-essential but fun and wonderful things. And you go to, like, Nigella Lawson's book, Domestic Goddess.
How to be a
Domestic Goddess, which is mostly desserts. And then there's, again, that sexualization and the frivolousness of it and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm always a little wary of that. And then also we have probably had the let them eat cake kind of thing. There are too many desserts. There's obesity in our culture. So when in my mind, I'm a little careful about those kinds of things. It pushes more towards the frivolous end of the nurturing that really, you know, you got to be able to make the soups first, okay?
That's it. Abby, you mentioned someone named Ruth Buxton Sayer as a person of interest. Can you tell me about her?
Yes, I would love to. So when Iowa State hired me, I was really interested in figuring out how Iowa women had played active roles in peace movements. And that led me to learn about Ruth Buxton Sayer, and some of her writings are held in special collections at Parks Library on campus.
So what's her lifespan? What period?
1896 to 1980.
Okay.
She's from Indianola, went to Simpson College, and she wrote quite a bit for the Farm Journal and other such publications. And she was known during her lifetime as the First Lady of the Farm. So her personal papers are also held at the State Historical Society in Iowa City, so anyone can go and look at them and learn more about what she wrote about. So she developed a theory of global citizenship directed toward women living on farms and rural women, and was very interested in helping women see and that agriculture was becoming a globalized entity, that if you were in agriculture, you should think about reading UN resolutions. And when you turned on your radio to hear the international news in the morning, you were participating and learning about the world. And that
is this the beginning of how Iowa has to, quote, feed the world?
She didn't address that.
Well, thank goodness.
So, yes, she, you know, did all sorts of interesting things with her life. Like, she traveled in the Mideast in the 50s and 60s and wrote about them for Farm Journal and sort of translated the experience back to farm audiences. And so I'm very interested in how she understood rhetorical strategies and how she would relate to audiences and different statements she would make in her speeches, how she, when she was photographed for publications, how she would position the scene of the photograph. For example, there's one where you can tell she's sitting in her dining room because the corner cabinet of dishes is behind her, but she's set up a desk in the dining room with the globe and a plume pen to secure her identity as a writer, as an expert on international issues related to farming. But yet you can still see this is the room in her home that's set aside for dining and for hosting guests, right? So I'm very much interested in that sort of combining of context and how a writer like her does that work. So I do have the privilege of – I'm a registered speaker with Humanities Iowa, so I get to talk about her at public libraries and other places around Iowa. It's such a privilege. I always learn more from my audience than I teach them, I think. But it's great to be able to talk about her. I think Iowans deserve to know their history, and I love learning about people who maybe don't get a lot of attention in other contexts and sort of teaching them about what women have done in Iowa historically.
Mm-hmm. She seems like a, when you think about it, a powerful person, a woman that was very articulate, and at that time, just another homemaker. Hearing her or reading her, it kind of opens your eyes when you read a statement, and then you look at the author, and oh, it's a woman mm-hmm. that wrote that. There's something about, especially during that time, or the early part of the past century here, and women have changed, the roles of women have changed a lot, but it's due to the fact that there was a lot of small awakenings happening, while women were listening to the radio or reading their newspaper or talking to each other over the back fence. I mean, that's really small events mm-hmm. make a big difference.
Well, ISU also has a history of the home ec department mm-hmm. being yeah. rather, well, of course, it was a career where women were allowed, home economics and nursing, of course. And ISU had a large, fairly well-reputed department for that. Now it's called something completely different. But have you worked with that part of the history also?
Well, Ruth Buxton Sayre did publish in the Journal of Home Economics and has other work in that context. So I've barely, hit the tip of the iceberg in even learning about her. Mm-hmm. But Amy Bix in the history department has done some really fascinating work that I encourage your listeners to look up. And I've
Amy
Bix, B-I-X, and I taught a course on feminist theory and technical communication, and we read a bunch of her work. She's dug into Iowa State's history. So, for example, women students in these domestic technology courses, they would have to take apart a refrigerator and put it back together so it worked for their classes.
What a great idea.
I know. And they would have to they would be on call for community or for Citizens and Ames, where you could call campus and ask a student to come to your house and help you rewire your lamp. And in some of these materials, it's still all written for domestic feminine roles. Like if you're going to host a luncheon for your lady friends and your stove breaks, you need to know how to fix it before your guests arrive. And so the connection between technical knowledge and cooking is, you know, long and rich. So, yes, I highly encourage people to look up Amy Bix's work. She's also written her most recent book is about women starting to be admitted to engineering programs. And I have heard her present about it once, in the campus newspapers reporting on women's admission into engineering programs, the metaphor and the verb of invade is used over and over and over again, like women invade engineering. So, again, just thinking about ways.
Let's put the fear of God in these men. Oh, boy.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. The words make a big difference. You've got still have a pile of books over there. Do you have other things
I have
to say about them?
Well, an example, just thinking about all the ingenious ways people have fed other people, and some of the examples from this Greenwich Peace Center book, Greenwich Village Peace Center book, talk about how little money they would have in order to be able to cook for a group of people, and how they would really stretch a few cents or a few dollars just to try to cook for as many people as possible. So folks who are also interested in that aspect of thinking about food and what it means to have access to food and healthy food, there's also material in these cookbooks that would interest them as well, I think.
That's great. So do you like to cook?
Yes, I do.
Oh, what do you like to cook? Or when you go to the kitchen, how do you like to empower yourself by cooking something?
Well, as someone who has to write for a living, so with writing and with research, there's not always instant gratification, right? It's a process. And every day is a new opportunity to work more and write more and research more. But with cooking, there's instant gratification because you can have some beautiful ingredients and a little bit of time and you get to eat it, which is, as Julia Child said, with cooking, you get to eat your mistakes, which I think is brilliant. For me, cooking is a really powerful avocation because it can balance out the other work that I get to do in my life, family and friends. I've taught one class at Wheatsfield, and thinking about, as someone who's also a teacher, thinking about the way I teach people to cook and the way I teach people in my courses has been an interesting reflection for me to do, too, because sometimes, teaching someone to cook can be really, really rewarding. I think we should all know how to cook, so that's important to me as well.
I found out about you because you sent around a notice that you were interested in a project that you're working on, and you were looking for people to help you with this project. Can you tell me about what's going on in the future?
Yes, thank you. So in my field, we also do person-based research where we conduct interviews and do oral histories. And so I'm currently recruiting participants, so people who identify as women and farmers or food workers, to sit down to do an interview with me. I ask them about their rhetorical strategies, which means their persuasive strategies, how they use communication in their job, that sort of thing. And I'm really interested in getting practitioners' thoughts on different claims that are being made right now in the media, that women are the future of agriculture or that food is a feminist issue. I want to hear practitioners' opinions on these issues. And really, I'm trying to gain as many different perspectives as possible. With me, I've done plenty of in-person interviews around Iowa, but I have several years to work on this, and I'm just really trying to gain some perspective and gain some visibility to individuals who are often, you know, hidden or undervalued as we think about who brings our food to us, who's working in our communities, and all that other sort of work. So, yes, if anyone's interested in speaking to me and doing an interview with me, my email address is my last name, which is spelled D as in dog, U B as in boy, ISAR, at iastate.edu. And if folks would reach out to me, I would really appreciate it.
And tell us what will happen to this research.
It will be published in academic venues like journal articles. I'm working on a book called Food, Farming, and Feminism.
Are you trying to write this also for a general audience?
Maybe. There's some.
I would encourage you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think there's a lot of public interest in it, just the
absolutely.
Fact that Lana invited me to be on your show. But yes, absolutely. I think people want to know more about sort of how people in their community, especially a community like Ames or in Iowa, when we're so affected and a part of the agricultural system, what
yes,
workers.
Yes, right here in the belly of the beast.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's a privilege to have access to these women's experiences. I've learned so much already, and I've done about a dozen interviews so far.
That's one thing I have learned is that just try to sell something at a farmer's market
mm-hmm.
once. People want to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much that I spend my time forcefully
pushing tomatoes.
No,
yeah.
No. I think communication happens when we say, oh, so what's your favorite tomato? What do you have a good salsa recipe? The dialogue, the stories that happen, and they can be – they're not – it's not a forceful sort of thing at all. It's people talking to one another. And who would think that recipes and food could touch us so deeply? Oh, we know they do. We knew they do.
Mm-hmm. And those stories, I mean, that's essential to what I study in my field of rhetoric, that stories are very persuasive and we want to connect with one another. And thinking about what's emerging trend in my research so far is just how important forming relationships is. And so someone, if they come to, you know, buy something from a farmer at the farmer's market, you know, my participants talk about how people want to have a relationship with the person who's growing their food. And yes, but relationships and stories are so central.
We are in the kitchen with Abby Dubasar. Thank you for joining us today. Do you want to give your contact information again? She seems like a fine person that you just want to talk to.
In case you all want to be part of this cooking food feminine research.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. This is delightful. So my email address is D as in dog, U, B as in boy, ISAR at iastate.edu. And my first name is Abby, ABBY. Thank you.
Very good. This is KHOI was the Tom Bigby Waltz. I hope you were waltzing around your kitchen table. We're talking about recipes and rhetoric today. Donna, you've got a little bit of experience with recipes. Tell us what you know.
Well, recipe writing, let's just say that not all recipe writers are created equally. Especially now that everything is on the internet and you can write a recipe and just put it up there and bam, it's done. Traditionally, recipes for books were thoroughly tested. Sometimes, you know, cooked over and over and over again to make sure they did it properly and, you know, that we got a lot of quick and dirty right now. And it just, you know, doesn't always... I mean, people will say to me, oh, I tried this recipe on the internet, and you know what? It just didn't work. Well, that is disappointing, and part of it is because there's a lot that goes into writing a recipe. You know, first of all, you're explaining something that it's not just, you know, the measurements. And then you have to describe how you put it together when essentially learning to cook was something people did like it's an oral tradition. You know, you learn from your mother, you learn from your grandmother, that kind of seeing and doing with hands on, and this is how the dough should look, and this is how it should smell, and this is how it should taste. Because also there are a lot of variables in ingredients too. For example, especially with your baking, some flours, not all flours are even all, they become pretty standardized. But, for example, if you want to cook with a local flour, like Early Morning Harvest or something, it will not necessarily work in the recipe the same way the gold medal unbleached would work. Mm-hmm. Also, the weather affects food and mm-hmm. baking. And like with herbs and spices, the freshness of them makes a huge difference. So it is...
And back to sizes of things. Eggs.
Right.
One egg. As someone who has a flock of chickens, one egg could mean something rather pullet-sized, and you don't want to waste this. Or there, sometimes they really go all out, and you get a great big one, or maybe even a double yolk one.
Yeah, well, some recipes will say, you know, two extra large eggs.
Extra large. There
so
you go.
Even after the recipe is written, you know, you'll see this in cookbooks. Some cookbook writers, and these often are very experienced people, there is an art form to the description of it. You want it to be thorough enough so that everyone understands. Plus, you want it to be simple enough that it's not, you know, 5 pages long how to do this. You know, so you'll see some people are able to write a very concise recipe with pretty explicit directions, mm-hmm. and other people have to ramble on, and you look at the text and go, ugh, I don't want to be bothered, you know. And then in a reputable cookbook, of course, it's all tested and edited, and, you know, that's quite a process. But with the internet, some of that's been dispensed with, you know.
Yeah, so. It seems like putting up a pretty picture, well, that's what it's supposed to look like at the end. But it usually is a pretty circuitous route to get there. One thing I've learned about recipes, I tend to, well, as I often say, I cook from the hip. I don't use, recipes kind of are just the starting point for me. Except for baking. Mm-hmm. But when recipes, you have a list of things, yes, got all
those
things.
List of ingredients, yep. That's right.
But there's so many. Meanwhile, before you do this, don't forget to remember to do. And if that doesn't happen at the right time in the recipe, or I guess I should just always read the recipe through first.
Yes, because you are supposed to do that, Lana. I mean, you know, only if you want to. There is this thing, I just call it the tyranny of the recipe, though. With baking, because there are a lot of chemical reactions going on, you kind of have to follow the recipe in terms of how much dry ingredient, how much wet ingredients, and what the leavenings are, and things like that. but for other kinds of cooking, you know, the throw it in the pot sort of cooking, mm-hmm. There's a lot of leeway there.
Yeah.
And I would always recommend anybody to add more, go for the deep flavor. You know, I've never seen a recipe that said a half a teaspoon of cinnamon where a whole teaspoon wouldn't be better.
That's a fine philosophy.
I mean, there are a few spices you don't want to like too much rosemary doesn't taste good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you learn.
Yeah, but there are not too many of them that too much doesn't taste better.
My husband often tells me that my philosophy is if some is good, more is better. So that's
exactly.
Kind of how I cook.
Exactly. Don't be stingy with the flavors.
Recipe books more and more, I suppose they always were, but recipe books more and more have the prose and poetry of the writer. I mean, I love reading about food and these great long backgrounds into the shopping expeditions and what was going on outside the kitchen window. I love reading that, but I have to remember, that's not the recipe. The recipe should
right, that
be clear.
Should be, that should be the prologue to the recipe. If someone wants to read that, that's fine. But and it's a setup for making you, oh, I think I'll try this, you know. But the recipe in itself and the body should be the list mm-hmm. of ingredients in order that they are used. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, a description of how you incorporate them step by step and what you do.
Very good. Very good.
And feel free to add your own flavors anytime.
Yes.
You don't have to follow that recipe.
And when you're passing on a recipe to somebody else, kind of proofread it before you do that, because I've had people call me back and say, are you sure this is right? And I just plain wrote something down wrong. It can happen. But it's not a tragedy.
That's why cookbook writers have editors.
Editors.
And testers. They catch all of that.
Oh, very good. I like that. Good. Speaking of current things, we mentioned that it's still winter here. There's ice and snow outside today, and the Olympics are going on. Are you watching any of the Olympics?
Only the photos that come up on, like, CNN or something.
Oh,
not too much.
The best of the best. Okay. I sort of go through this stuff, and I don't watch it religiously, but it's kind of nice to watch these people fling themselves down mountainsides and shoost across the ice. And, oh, my, I just get tired watching it. And I did watch – I like watching the ice dancing because it's so pretty. But the agony of defeat, these people doing the most beautiful things you've ever heard, and then the announcers or the judges saying, oh, but there was this little thing you did wrong, and you get 20 points off. I don't know. But
that's
I enjoy
the nature
it.
Of competitive.
That's true. That's true. But it is that time of the year when people are doing things in the Olympics. And I still can't figure out luge. I don't, this luge thing, down the hill head first. Oh, what a silly thing.
I don't know. The way our ice is, if we just tilted our landscape a little bit, we could be luging all over town right now.
Well, thinking of the Olympics, I have a book to recommend. This is the Olympics of 2018, right? Yeah, it's happening in South Korea now. But the Olympics has a long history, and I'm reading a book about the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And it's about the story of a crew team, a rowing team from Washington State. The book is called The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Daniel James Brown is the author. I'm not even quite through the whole thing, but it's a story about the nine crew members, the guys who actually, this was a kind of a new thing for the Olympics and crew rowing in general, because here's, instead of the Ivy League folks out there in their crew and the sons of rich men doing this, this happened to be a group put together, sons of loggers and seamen and fishermen and farmers from the Seattle area. And they just happened to have a really good coach and a really good boat builder. And the 1936 Olympics was coming up. They were coming out of the Depression. There's a lot of backstory into all these people here. So it's interesting. A nice story about the times. But 1936 was the a lot of ominous things going on. Maybe think about what's happening in our area, in our times now. This was when Hitler and Berlin, Germany, staged the Olympics?
It's a very famous Olympic.
Oh, yeah. Period. And the idea, Joseph Goebbels was using the Olympics very, very much for his propaganda campaigns about.
Oh, gee. Oh, what a concept. Yeah.
What a concept. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But who's better than one another? And thinking about imperialism and people showing off in politics, coming very, very much into this. I found out in this thing that the 1936 Olympics was the first time that the Olympic torch was carried from Greece to the hosting country. And that was, we do that yet today. That was one of Joseph Goebbels' idea that, we're going to have all these Aryan looking
folks. If only that were all he were known for.
Yeah, right. We could give him the Olympics. But evidently, these nine Americans, the crew team, the rowing team from Seattle, Washington, the University of Washington, kind of got together and did real good that year. So I'll recommend this book is a good read. It was passed on by a friend. Thank you, Nate, for passing this on. The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold in the 1936 Berlin Olympics by Daniel James Brown.
Yes, Lana and I are big patrons of the library.
Yes.
And rather eclectic readers we are here. It's not all cookbooks.
You never know.
Oh, or seed catalogs.
No. We actually find out a lot about how much food these guys have to eat because they work hard. They work hard. There's some upcoming things going on.
Well, tonight there is a showing of a new film called Farmers for America. It's at the ISU Alumni Building. And it's a documentary to celebrate, inspire, and support young farmers. Lana and Joe and I are going. We'll let you know about it afterwards. It's another film by Graham Merriweather, who's the director and the producer. He, a few years ago, I met him, the young man. He was American Meat, a pro-farmer story showcasing the unique agricultural innovations underway at Polyface Farms in Virginia.
Very good. So Joe Salatin and folks, very good.
We'll see tonight, we'll see a Farmers for America, beginning Farmers in Iowa.
Good. Give a time and place.
All right. 6 to 9, ISU Alumni Center. I think you had to RSVP, but I'm not sure. I would say a lot of people are not going to come tonight. So if you're in town and you can slip and slide over there, you'll probably get in.
Good. We will. I'll give you a report on that next week. Also, next week, we kind of have something up our sleeve here. Donna Lena Kitchen, we're kind of going to look into some easy
family food.
Yeah, empower yourself in the kitchen. You don't have to go fancy recipe here. This is the kind of stuff that we're going to feed our tummies and feed our souls. Yes.
Yes, especially because this is the, from now until we hit the asparagus and the nettles, it's kind of a dreary season in the bottom of the larder and digging out the root cellar and, you know.
Well, there are treasures down in that in the freezer yet.
Plus, I have to say, of course, the avocados and the citrus in the stores right now, this is pretty fabulous.
We are lucky. We do not lack food here in Central Iowa.
I was a little worried about the citrus this year, you know, because the hurricanes took out a lot of citrus in the South, both in Texas and in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then worse than that, we have this multi-years of something called the citrus greening disease, which is killing trees. It's bad,
not
bad,
good.
Bad, bad. And one of these days we're going to just wake up and there might not be any citrus. And every year I think, oh, I know. Hope I get my grapefruits this year. I'm a big grapefruit juice fan.
On that happy note, my goodness.
Well, I got my grapefruits this year.
Good.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Donna Lena Kitchen. You can listen every Tuesday. It's repeated every Tuesday at noon. It's repeated 7 p.m. Or you go to khoifm.org for more about this station and this show. Music today by Tim Jenkins and Joseph Rubeck on their CD, We're Cooking Now. And we're going out with a tune called New chinkapin. New chinkapin hunting. Hunting.
By the chinkapin?
I don't know what a chinkapin is. And by the Barn Owl Band. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.